In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah, it's time to talk movies on Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joins us. Hello there, Alan.
Hello there, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How's your Monday so far?
It's pretty freaking cold out there, Rich.
Oh, mamacita. But look, don't put the shorts away. 50s midweek, near 60 this time next week.
That's what I'm hearing. And just for the record, the shorts did come out.
Friday?
They came out on Friday.
Excellent. Excellent.
So, yes. Putting them away was hard. Like waking up on Saturday and being like, I should put pants back on. nobody needs pants in their life. Certainly not for any longer than is absolutely necessary.
Right. But as long as, look, they're close enough that you can get them when you need them. That's the key.
Oh yeah, in case of emergency, break glass. Like they're right there.
Well, this was, of course, Oscar nomination day, and 8 different films up for Best Picture. Any surprises there, or surprising omissions for you?
You know, I think the big surprise for me for the Best Picture category is the absence of One Night in Miami. Like that was the one that I really thought would. I had a list of 9 in my head, and it's basically the 8 that they nominated plus One Night in Miami. Like that was pretty much what I thought was going to happen. Like I was holding out hope for maybe a surprise, like something like like Spike Lee's The Five Bloods maybe sliding in under the wire or something like that. But my hopes weren't particularly high just because that movie has unfortunately been largely forgotten. This award season, which is kind of a bummer, but you know, it's a pretty good list of movies. I think it's nice to see something like Minari getting as much attention as it is, simply because just by the weird convoluted nature of the Hollywood foreign press, it wasn't able to really get a lot of traction at the Golden Globes. So to see the Academy not repeating that sort of mistake was really nice. So yeah, it's a pretty solid list. Like we've certainly had worse Best Picture slates kicking around out there for sure.
And it was great, although Regina King did not get a nomination, but 2 women did for Best Director. So that's certainly some good news.
Yeah, you know, it's great. 2 women, one of them a woman of color, Chloe Zhao. And so just getting this opportunity to sort of, I don't know, like just, it just feels like there's a, we're venturing towards a more inclusive kind of vibe in those sorts of categories. Although, I mean, again, like not to harp on this one thing, but I'll concede that I have not seen Another Round, the Danish movie directed by Thomas Vinterberg, which received a Best Director nomination. So I can't say for certain. It seems weird to me that they would substitute him in for Regina King for her work on One Night in Miami. But again, the Academy is known for doing this every few years, picking one of the more acclaimed international features and giving it some love in other categories. And I think that's an example of what's happening here. But yeah, I mean, between Chloe Zhao and Emerald Fennell, like, I mean, I think that's great. And, you've got Lee Isaac Chung for Minari. Like, it's a wonderfully, as far as diversity goes, like, you know, the Academy's not there yet. I think we can all agree on that. But between nominations like that, Viola Davis and Andra Day getting nominated for Best Actress. 2 actors of Asian descent nominated for Best Actor in a leading role, had never happened before. So you've got Riz Ahmed, who's Pakistani descent, I think, and then Steven Yeun, who's Korean. And I just learned this today, Riz Ahmed, first Muslim nominated in that category.
Wow.
So, yeah, so, and I mean, not that any of it matters, an actor in a leading role, because it's going to be Chadwick Boseman's show. I don't think there's any disputing. It's as big a slam dunk as I think you can have in a ceremony like this. But still, it's really great that those guys are getting nominated and standing alongside, real like giants of the industry like Anthony Hopkins and Gary Oldman. So it's nice to sort of see things balancing out just a little bit, which is nice.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we'll talk more about that as we get closer to the awards ceremony. But you did see a couple of new films. What would you like to start with?
I did see a couple of new films. Let's talk about this one really quick, just because I wasn't sure where I was going to come down on this, and I wound up actually having a pretty good time. So there's this movie called Kid 90. It's a documentary currently streaming on Hulu. And it's when I first heard about it, I admit I had a good deal of curiosity. So it's directed by Soleil Moon Frye, best known as TV's Punky Brewster. And the deal with this is, apparently, she spent her entire adolescence, like teenage years up through into her early, like through college into her early 20s, with a video camera in her hand.
Wow.
And so she basically, like, there was a camera, like she was pointing a camera at everything that was going on around her during those years. But apparently what she did was, like, at a certain point in her mid-20s, she just sort of put all these things away and kind of forgot about them. And then just recently sort of unearthed them and started going back through them and sort of reopening what she refers to as kind of a Pandora's box. And so we have this wonderful documentary about kind of what it was like to grow up in the business. And it's all built around these old videotapes. And Rich, like, if you watched television from the mid-80s to the early 90s, you are going to recognize a lot of faces in these videos. Because, you know, they're kids in Hollywood, so they all just hung out together. And so you see all these, like, these parties, you know, and like when they're younger, the parties are very innocent. And as we progress, they become considerably less innocent. But, you know, and the big ones are maybe not like mega famous folks, people like, you know, Brian Austin Green or Mark Paul Gosselaar or, you know, sort of her peers in that kind of thing. But you also get glimpses of much bigger names. You know, folks like, you know, like DiCaprio shows up a couple of times, you know, briefly, like, because again, like, and so you're just watching, you know, and interspersed through it all, we get the talking head interviews, that she does with some of these people like Green and, Gosselaar. She talks to Balthazar Getty a bunch, Stephen Dorff, and then some other sort of more, more esoteric kind of people that you wouldn't have expected Soleil Moon Frye to be connected with, like former Jane's Addiction frontman Perry Farrell appears a couple of times.
Okay.
She actually dated one of the dudes from House of Pain. And there's a very I'm not going to go so far as to call it salacious because it's all handled very tastefully, but there's a reveal regarding one of Soleil Moon Frye's early romantic experiences that involves someone who's very familiar to everybody and who was maybe a little too old to be going after a woman of her age at that time. But I'm not going to spoil it because you really should. It's a big reveal and I don't want to give it away. But yeah, it's really interesting. It's this wonderful sort of perspective, like through one person's experience in growing up in the business, from being like mega famous as a kid to sort of muddling through Hollywood in her teen years. Then she goes to college. Like she went to the Actors Studio, and so she, like, there's a New York frame of reference here as well, and it's all just this sort of refracted through this prism of, you know, all these videotapes. And she saved her, you know, she had audio recordings from voicemails and like all of her journals when she was growing up. So it's this really remarkable kind of collection of documents that, frankly, aren't necessarily assembled in a particularly fantastic way. Like, she's not a filmmaker, and so, you know, you don't necessarily, like, they're old videotapes at various states of degradation, So you have that aspect to deal with. But in terms of just sort of shining a light on what it was like to be her in that time, it's pretty fascinating. It's also really short. Like, it's only about 70 minutes or so. So it's a pretty quick watch. And as someone who basically came of age at the same time as all of these people, like, it was really fascinating for me. And I think other people who have that sort of connection will also find it really interesting to watch.
Excellent. We're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge. What else did you see this weekend?
So I saw a movie called Yes Day. Now, are you familiar with Yes Days, Rich?
I am not.
The father of a youngster?
Nope.
Apparently, this is a thing where parents designate a day in which they're not allowed to say no to their kids.
Oh, what is wrong with these people?
Well, and obviously there are ground rules that are set in certain parameters that can't be breached. But yeah, the basic reality is it's this idea to sort of remove the sort of negation aspect of parenthood. Now, I don't necessarily think that that's something that parents need to do. I think it's important for there to be boundaries with regards to parents and children.
Yes.
And, the whole buddy-buddy thing doesn't necessarily always turn out the way you want it to. I'll just put it that way. But anyway, so that is the premise of this movie. It's a Netflix joint family film based on a children's book of the same name. And it's basically the story of this one family's sort of adventure that takes place when they decide that they're going to have a yes day. It's charming enough. It's pretty slight. Like, it's agreeable. It's like an hour and a half, so it's not particularly long. And it's not the kind of movie that's going to linger after the credits roll. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with a kid's movie that kind of leans into the sensibility of the target demographic. Like, there's some goofiness and some fun moments. And ostensibly, there are lessons learned, but, you know, your mileage may vary. And what you get is something that's, you know, basically an inoffensive sort of offering that'll go down pretty smoothly. It stars Jennifer Garner and Edgar Ramirez as Allison and Carlos Torres. They're parents. They were an adventurous pair when they first met. Like, over the course of their courtship and the early parts of their marriage, they were very much about embracing opportunities whenever they were presented. Lives built around saying yes. But when they had kids, that changed, and yes became no. And so Allison has become kind of the naysayer of the family, the one tasked with the most knowing to their three kids. Carlos, he's a lawyer for a tech company, so he spends his entire day telling all sorts of people no. So he tries to, you know, basically foists off the task of being the heavy at home on his wife. They learn at a parent-teacher conference that the situation, their kids' impression of them has deteriorated pretty significantly. And so they decide, they get advice from the school counselor, and that's when they learn about Yes Day. And they decide, you know what, we're going to do a Yes Day. And, Rich, believe it or not, hijinks ensue. yeah, there's, you know, like, ice cream eating contests and car washes with windows down and paintball fights, just a bunch of absurd, goofy kid movie stuff. But there's also some family, you know, dynamic stuff folded in there and lessons to be learned and whatever. Look, it's fine. The movie's fine. It's formulaic and predictable. There's nothing surprising. The logistics of the movie make zero sense, even though they also feel completely expected. But, you know, it's also a portrayal of a family that obviously loves each other. And even when they're in conflict, there's none of the mean-spiritedness that you sometimes get in this sort of film. You know, focusing on communication and trying to be fair. It's very middle of the road. Like, you're not going to get your hair blown back. It's basically, it's a movie that will occupy you for precisely the length of its 86 minutes and not 1 second more.
All right.
So, yeah, you could do worse.
Let's move from there on to Cherry.
I was curious about this one because there are a number of factors that go into this movie that made me wonder what it was going to be like. Like, first of all, there's the story of the novel. It's by a guy named Nico Walker. Came out in 2018. And there's this whole story about the movie because he wrote it while he was incarcerated. And so, like, wrote it on a typewriter in, like, the prison commissary or whatever. And, like, there are these stories about how difficult it was to even option the film rights because he had limited phone time. And so negotiations were very difficult. Add to that the factor that it's, you know, it's the first non-MCU film in ages from the Russo brothers, from Joe and Anthony Russo, and they're also bringing along Tom Holland from the MCU and sort of giving him an opportunity to sort of escape somewhat from the shadow cast by Spider-Man. And so it's a really, so there are all these sort of disparate sort of factors that went into making this movie. And it's not, like, it's a movie, it's a very heavy movie, very much a departure for pretty much everyone involved. Like, you know, it's a movie about war, you know, and it's about the sort of what happens when we send our young men off to war, and they're you know, somehow damaged, whether it's physically or psychologically or both, by that experience, and the fact that we don't give them the support they need and deserve when they come back. Like, that's kind of what this movie is about. So our narrator, he winds up being called Cherry, but we never actually learn his name. That's Tom Holland. He's going to school. He's going to college. He lives in Cleveland and becomes infatuated with one of his classmates, a young lady named Emily, played by Cara Bravo. And this sort of initial infatuation blooms into a relationship. You know, they get into it very hot and heavy. Things develop very quickly. But when he confesses that he loves her, she panics and decides that she's going to move away to Canada. She's going to go to Montreal and go to school there. His heart's broken. And so due to conversations that he had had previously with some of his buddies, he decides he's going to, you know, he doesn't know what else to do, so he enlists in the military. Like, that's his decision. He's going to become a medic in the military. Of course, as soon as he enlists, it turns out Emily realizes she's made a mistake and confesses her love to him, but it's too late. Like, he can't get out of going. She says she wants to wait for him, so they wind up doing a city hall marriage before he ships out. His time in the Middle East is extremely intense, extremely traumatic, confronted with a number of horrible experiences that I'm not going to go into detail about. Just know that it gets pretty graphic. It gets pretty visceral, you know, and he's experiencing all this in real time and, you know, not ever having the ability to really process it. You know, he comes home, you know, he's left with PTSD. And as he struggles with that pain, he gets foisted off by a completely disinterested VA doctor, actually dubbed Dr. Whomever, and it's played by Thomas Lennon, who's great. But they basically throw some pills at him, OxyContin, and say, you know, good luck to you. Unsurprisingly, spirals into abuse, and it's a spiral that takes in not just him, but the people around him, which leads him to make some pretty drastic and life-altering choices going forward, choices that cause a great deal of harm to a lot of people. I'm not going to go too much more into detail just because there's a lot that happens here, and it's best to sort of let it play out as mm-hmm. it will.
Okay.
But again, it's pretty rough in places. It's pretty tough to watch. You know, it's always difficult to watch people sort of spiral into that sort of that self-destruction kind of thing, and that's what we see here. We get to watch sort of a life fall apart. Look, I mean, there's a lot here. It's like the movie's almost 2.5 hours long, but I think it earns the majority of that time. Like, it's got a very winding road in terms of its internal storyline, but it's kind of best to let that unspool at its own pace. It meanders a little, Sometimes it feels almost lethargic, but I feel like there's a deliberateness there as far as the Russos are concerned. But that said, there are some really just sharp, sharp aesthetic choices made here. Like there's a chapter heading device dividing the film into parts, which is really good. There's a very liberal use of stylized, unconventional angles. And again, they're really good at using sort of outside imagery to accentuate our lead's dissociation from the world. I mentioned Dr. Whomever. Like, there are a number of characters with nameplates or name tags, and it's just whomever. Like, the whole point is that, you know, other people aren't real to him mm-hmm. anymore. And then you see, like, signage for businesses featuring, like, these very reductive and vague and sometimes expletive-ridden sort of language in an effort to show, you know, his perception of how these institutions view the people, you know, around them. It gets a little muddied sometimes. Like, there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot happening. And so by trying to comment on so much, we lose a little bit of specificity. But again, like, you could argue that this is all springing from the unreliability of the narrator's perspective, and I'd buy that. Look, this is a huge swing from Tom Holland. Like, he's obviously trying to, you know, trying to avoid getting sort of typecast with the superhero brush. And he's pretty good, although the truth is, like, he's always going to look like he's kind of a teenager, and so that makes it a little bit tougher to buy him in a part like this, but it's a pretty good turn. Like, and the supporting cast is really solid. Cara Bravo is very talented, a little bit of a thankless role, and some wonderful supporting performances. Forrest Goodluck is here as Cherry's best friend. Some great turns. Jack Rayner, best known as the dude in the bear suit from Midsummer, he shows up as a bro-y drug dealer. Who's
all right? We're gonna have to save the rest for later because we are hopelessly out of time, Alan. But
Rich, what are you doing to me?
leaving people wanting more.
We'll go with that. Yep, I do go on. I apologize.
Not at all. It wasn't you. It was Chakiris. Yeah, it's. What are you going to do? All right, we'll talk more, Al, on Wednesday.
Sounds good, man.
All right, thanks, Alan. Alan Adams of The Main Edge.